This morning we're looking at John chapter 4, picking up at verse 43. While people find that and flip, I'll just kind of mention, I've been trying to bring out some of the structural elements of the Gospel of John. This is the second of the seven signs. We spoke about how the first half of the Gospel is called the Book of Signs, and there's a series of seven signs which are demonstrating who Jesus is. This is the second of those seven. But also, Jesus is going to be interacting with an individual, and it follows on those two others that we just looked at, where Jesus is dealing with Nicodemus and where Jesus is dealing with the Samaritan woman at the well. And some writers see those three interviews as a set, that John is putting those three together, in which case it may be significant that Nicodemus is dealing with an intellectual problem, the Samaritan woman's dealing with more of a psychological issue, and this guy is dealing with a physical issue. Also, people debate whether the official that we're going to see today was a Jew or a Gentile. If he were a Gentile, then in the three interviews we would see Nicodemus as a Jew, the Samaritan woman as a Samaritan, and then this man as a Gentile. But it's also possible that John was not necessarily grouping today's passage with Nicodemus and the Samaritan woman. And I tend to lean that way simply because the interaction with Nicodemus is very drawn out. We see a lot of who he is. The dealing with the Samaritan woman is also very drawn out. We see a lot of who she is. And the two are such a contrast to each other, like we brought out last week. And then today's passage is very small. We don't learn much about the man, so I'm not sure that John was intentionally putting this with the two people that we just dealt with in the last 2 weeks. But in either case, it definitely is the second of the seven signs. And I don't hear the pages turning, so I assume everybody's gotten there. Chapter 4, verse 43. After the 2 days that he spent in the Samaritan village, he left for Galilee. Now Jesus himself had pointed out that a prophet has no honor in his own country. When he arrived in Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him. They had seen all that he had done in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, for they also had been there. Once more, he visited Cana in Galilee, where he had turned the water into wine. And there was a certain royal official whose son lay sick at Capernaum. When this man heard that Jesus had arrived in Galilee from Judea, he went to him and begged him to come and heal his son, who was close to death. "Unless you people see miracles, miraculous signs and wonders," Jesus told him, "you will never believe." The royal official said, "Sir, come down before my child dies." Jesus replied, "You may go. Your son will live." The man took Jesus at his word and departed. While he was still on the way, his servants met him with the news that his boy was living. When he inquired as to the time when his son got better, they said to him, "The fever left him yesterday at the seventh hour." Then the father realized that this was the exact time at which Jesus had said to him, "Your son will live." So he and all his household believed. This was the second miraculous sign that Jesus performed, having come from Judea to Galilee. The word of God for the people of God. So the two things that we have going on in the passage is, first we have the Galileans. We have this group of people who Jesus is returning to, having been in Passover in Jerusalem. And then the second is this royal official's son, who would have been very wealthy, he would have been very powerful, he would have been very connected. He is from Herod Antipas's court in Capernaum. And the Galileans are going to provide a backdrop for what Jesus wants to bring out in his dealing with this royal official. So what we see about the Galileans here is Jesus is returning. It specifically says, John points out that Jesus is returning to Cana of Galilee, where he had turned the water into wine. The fact that John brings that out indicates that that Jesus is intentionally heading back to see what had happened, right? We know that Jesus doesn't go around just doing miracles for the sake of miracles. He's not interested in spectacle. He's not interested in just kind of showing off. That whenever Jesus did miracles, it was for the specific reason to demonstrate who he was so that people would be enabled to make a proper response to who he was. When Jesus did signs and miracles, it was in order that people would believe, and believing that their lives would change. So Jesus is returning to Cana of Galilee to see what has happened. A couple of weeks ago, most likely, maybe a couple of months ago, he had been there, he had done this miracle, and now he's going back to see what's happened. And then, interestingly, we have two statements as to how the Galileans received him that appear to contradict each other. But in reality, the tension between the two statements kind of indicate or show us the state or of the Galileans, what they were going through. First, it says, Jesus himself had pointed out that a prophet has no honor in his own country. And we're familiar with that idea from the other Gospels, that when Jesus would return to his home country, Galilee, that people were too familiar with him. They had a hard time accepting his claims of who he really was. They had a hard time relating to him for who he was because they knew him. He was one of them. They were casual, you could say, with him. They didn't honor him. They didn't recognize who it was that he was. But it also says, when he arrived in Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him. Right? It says that they're excited that he shows up. Because, and John explains himself, because they had seen, this is verse 45, they had seen all that he had done in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, for they had also been there. Now, John says that they had seen all that Jesus had done at the Passover feast, but the gospel hasn't told us what Jesus had done at the Passover feast. Right? In the gospel, the only other miracle that we've heard so far is the turning of water into wine, which happened in Galilee. But we do know that while Jesus was in Jerusalem for that week of the Passover and whatever time he was there before and after, that he did a lot of miraculous signs that aren't recorded in the gospel. Remember, when Nicodemus comes to Jesus, the whole reason Nicodemus is struggling is because Jesus has been doing miraculous signs. You remember, he comes and he says, "Teacher, we know you are from God because no one could do what you do." Okay? So we know that while Jesus had been down at the Passover, he was doing signs that have not been recorded. The Galileans down there saw those same signs. As Jesus spends the Passover week in Jerusalem and he's healing people, as he's cleansing lepers, as he's possibly raising the dead to life, as he's doing the things that we know that he did, the Galileans are watching and they're loving it. Right? I mean, has anyone seen a really fantastic spectacle? Cirque du Soleil, say that. The first time I saw it, I've never been in person, but I've seen the videos that they put out. The first time I saw a Cirque du Soleil, did people know Cirque du Soleil? Yes? A few people do? Check it out. Whoa. The first time I saw a video of the circus, I mean, I just couldn't believe it. I was flying for like a month because I just couldn't believe the things that I saw. And it's funny, it's not just you walk away and, "That was really amazing." It's not this intellectual knowledge of, "Did you know what people can do if they work real hard?" It was like a high. I was personally thrilled, and I was turned on, and I couldn't wait to see coworkers and stuff the next day to tell them about this thing. I mean, it kind of did something to me, what it was that I saw, even though I only saw it on a TV. Okay? So the Galileans, they're pumped. They're having this incredible experience over the spectacle that they've seen down in Jerusalem. And to add to it all, Jesus is one of them. Right? They're in Jerusalem where they're frankly looked down on. They're the second-class citizens when they go to Jerusalem. And here's this miracle worker turning the city on its ear. Everybody's talking about him. And oh, did you know that he's from Nazareth? I live in Cana. That's like 4 miles away. I have cousins in Nazareth, right? So, I mean, they dig this thing, okay? And I was trying to liken to it. I'm not a sports person, you guys know. And so I even had to check with the first service people. Is Tom Brady still big? And people nodded their heads. Tom Brady is still big, okay. So if I were, say, in a bar down in Boston, and I haven't been in a bar down in Boston, you have to put that out. You have to make that clear. If you have recently, that's not necessarily a problem. And okay. So, anyways, we'll say that I'm down in a bar in Boston, and Tom Brady's having a big night, right? Everybody's going to be talking about Tom, but they're not going to be talking about Tom Brady because they're Boston guys, right? They're just talking about Tom, right? And everybody's going to be talking as though they like know him, as though they're their best friend. Hey, did you check out Tom last night? Yeah, man, he was really on, you know. And it's ridiculous, but we do that because we feel that we have some kind of connection to somebody, and it somehow makes us feel special, right? You're familiar with that whole idea? It's that hero mentality. You know, it's the in the 19th century with the immigrant, say the Irish immigrant community in Boston, and one of them comes along who's a phenomenal boxer, right? And the whole community, suddenly there's Irish pride, right? That doesn't mean that any of them know him. It doesn't mean that any of them can box. It doesn't mean that the Irish just got bigger or stronger or smarter or anything else. But there's this real hero mentality of we're now special because this guy has risen up from among us. And it has nothing to do with, oh, how wonderful he is. And it doesn't even have anything to do with the fact that I know him somehow. It's somehow I feel lifted up because of who he is. It's all about what I'm getting. How my life is improving because this guy has appeared and I can claim some kind of connection to him. This is where the Galileans are at this point. Jesus shows up, the miracle worker, and they're excited. They're pumped because they think they're going to see a spectacle. They're excited because the stuff that Jesus did in Jerusalem, now he's going to do here in our back little water town. He's going to put us on the map. Right, it's like in Charlotte's Web when Charlotte starts writing the words, you know, fantastic pig in the web, and the whole state starts coming into this little farm. Right? The Galileans are excited because Jesus is going to make them the center of attention. Jesus is going to basically entertain them. They have a faith in him. They do have a faith in him. There's a level of belief. If you asked any one of them, do you really think he can heal the lame? Oh, do I ever? I saw it with my own eyes. He can do it. Okay? There's a belief in him, but there's no personal interaction with him. There's a distance. They're looking, they have a belief in him, but it's a belief that wants to sit down over here and watch what he does and be thrilled by it. It actually comes down to a Jewish version of the Roman practice called bread and circus. People familiar with the idea of bread and circus? It wasn't an actual official policy of the Roman Empire, but it was the de facto way that they controlled crowds in Rome, starting actually a whole 150 years earlier than Jesus. Roman politicians figured out that they could maintain their status, they could keep themselves in power, and keep people fat, dumb, and happy by just regularly passing out food. There was a grain distribution in Rome, starting from 150, I think it was like 160 something BC, that every resident of Rome would receive a free distribution of grain every month. And then on top of that, there was the entertainment, circus, right? It was bread and circus. You keep them fed and you keep them occupied and they don't get involved in politics. It's actually really similar to what's going on in China nowadays. So the circus, particularly, the circus was something that would grab them. Okay? It was particularly a Roman circus. The circus was a bloody display of lethal force, right? I mean, it's guys in the arena killing each other or fighting with beasts. The Roman world was a world of power. It was a world of force. And the Romans' view of themselves was there on the top of that world because they were the military power. So even the particular form of circus that kept them satisfied was aimed at their image of themselves as the military power, their image of themselves as being in control because of their physical force. Okay? And in the same way, the circus that the Galilean Jews here want, it's aimed at their ego as well. Just as the Romans wanted a physical display of force because it stroked their ego of we are the ones who have the military force to impose our will on the world, the Jews' whole worldview and their idea of themselves was we are God's chosen people. We may be nothing, but God is everything, and he has chosen to put us at the top of the pyramid. And so the circus now that they're expecting from Jesus, the bread comes later, remember, in a couple chapters, but the entertainment now that their faith in him is all about is specifically designed, in their minds, to stroke their ego and pump them up that they are God's chosen people. So the Galileans' faith, their belief in Jesus, it's a legitimate belief. They believe that he is the Messiah. They believe that he can do these things that he claims he can do, but it has no personal interaction. It's they're going to be there as a crowd. They're going to cheer. They're going to watch. And they're going to feel special because of what Jesus does. And Jesus tells them just exactly what he thinks of this faith. It happens because this other guy shows up. This guy is from away. He has nothing to do with what's going on here. He doesn't care about what's going on here. He has other concerns that we'll get to in a minute. But he shows up and he asks Jesus to heal his son. You can imagine the electric little thrill that went through the crowd. Ooh, this is just what we're waiting for. Right? This plays right into their plans. This is why they're here. This is why they're in the crowd. This is why they've come out to welcome Jesus. They wanted to see something. And just like according to script, somebody comes up, he's got a son that's dying, heal my son. People are excited. And Jesus says to them, he's answering a question to the man, but he's really speaking to the crowd. And he says that this faith, this belief that's about signs and miracles, when he says, unless you people see miraculous signs and wonders, you will never believe. What he's saying is this faith of yours, or this belief of yours, that's all about signs and miracles, about seeing something here, has nothing to do with me. I'm not interested. It's unpleasing to me, and I will have nothing to do with it. Well, you can hear in his tone that there's a distance there. He's shutting them down, and he's saying, we're not going to do that. I'm not interested. That's not what it's about. Okay? And we know that he's speaking to the crowd for two reasons. One, he says you in the plural. When he says you people, he's speaking not to this one man. He's speaking to the crowd. And this man has nothing to do with the crowd. He's not from there. He's come from far away. He's walked for half a day to get there. He's possibly not even a Jew. He's from the big city. You know, it's like we're at a Woolwich town meeting and a guy walks in from Wall Street. You know, he's just not interested in what we're debating. It doesn't concern him. He's here because he needs to speak to somebody about a different matter. This guy is completely unconcerned, and Jesus is addressing you people. The other reason is that this whole question of signs and miracles and belief has nothing to do with this guy. Like I just kind of alluded to with the Wall Street guy showing up at a Woolwich town meeting. He doesn't care who Jesus is. He's not there because he's curious about who this Messiah is. He's not there because he's been waiting for the Messiah. He's not there because he has any interest in the popular beliefs of the hill country people up there in the wilderness. And that's really, this is a guy who's come from the big city, from the king's court to a small backwater town. He's uninterested. He's there specifically because he has a need. His son is dying, and this guy might be able to help. Basically, his attitude showing up here is, I don't know what you guys were all talking about, but I need you. Can you just come with me? Do this for me, and we'll part company. You can go back to the hills and argue belief with the Galileans, and I'll go back to my life. And incidentally, I can probably give you a really nice gift because I can do that. Okay? He's uninterested in this whole question of who Jesus is. It doesn't concern him. It's not his business. He's not interested in it. And so he repeats his question. He's insistent with the Lord. And he says, Sir, please come down before my child dies. And then in Jesus' response, you know, if we kind of really unpack it, it's almost as though Jesus says to him, you think this doesn't concern you? You think this doesn't have anything to do with you? I'm going to make it concern you. I'm going to stick you right in the middle of this question of belief in signs and miracles. Because Jesus' answer to him does. It sticks the man right in the middle of the question. It forces the man to make a decision about who Jesus is and whether or not he can believe him. Jesus says, go, your son will live. Right? The NIV kind of tacks on, you may go. In the Greek, it's just a one-word command. It says, go, your son will live. Okay? That puts the man in a really difficult position. What does he do? He has to make a choice. His first choice is he can insist. He can say, "No, sir, you don't quite understand. You don't know what's wrong with my son. You haven't seen him. You need to come." But if he does that, he risks insulting him. He risks insulting Jesus. Because to insist really is kind of saying, you don't know what's wrong with him. You don't know how special he is. You don't know what it is that needs to be done. And frankly, can you really do it from here? And then the biggest question is, if I leave right now, will you actually do it? He risks exposing all of that to Jesus if he insists. If he says, "Jesus, no, you need to come." He would be exposing that he's not willing to trust him. It would be basically the equivalent of saying, "I believe you can do this my way." Right? No, you didn't understand me. I want you to come with me. I want you to come, I want you to see him. I want you to put your hands on him. I want you to say something in some other language. You know, and I want you to come with me so that I know you're going to do it. I want you to walk the 6 hours that I had to walk to get here as an evidence of your good faith that you intend to do it. Right? You know, do you know that you do that? If you pray, you do the same thing. There may be a couple of people here who don't do that with God, but it's because you don't pray at all, right? Have you ever done that? You say, "God, I really need this done." And you know what? And you can do that. I know you can do that. I believe that you can do it. Especially if it happened this way. And we start. Have you ever caught yourself spelling out to God how he could fix your problem? That is the most ridiculous thing. And yet we all do it. Because we have a hard time accepting that he will just know what needs to be done and be able to do it. So the man, his first choice is to insist, but then to risk all of that. But his other choice is even worse. His other choice is just to leave. Effectively, to leave with nothing. And we are so accustomed to all of these stories ending with Jesus doing the healing. You know, we're used to all these stories, they all end the right way. You know, like Hollywood movies all end the right way. Right? That we can miss the fact that if the man leaves, he really risks leaving with nothing. And kind of an illustration, in Russia, you know, if you have to get anything done, very often the only way to really get something done is you nagla, which means rude, just by force of blunt-headed, beat the door down with your forehead. Get yourself in front of high enough official who can just do something, and then you lay your story out, and you don't leave his office until he does something about it. The first step is you get in there, and then as he tries to get you out, you don't leave until he actually writes it down and stamps it and hands it to you, or he picks up the phone and makes a call and tells one of the underlings that if they don't do it, they're going to get in trouble. If you walk in and you lay out your sob story and he says, "Oh, that's awful. I'm going to take care of you." If you say, oh, "Thank you," and get up and leave, in 5 minutes he's forgotten about you. Okay? This guy, he doesn't know who Jesus is. If he just gets up and leaves, he leaves with nothing. For him to obey Jesus, to leave, trusting that his son will be well, requires that he believes that Jesus actually knows who his son is, that he actually knows what's wrong with his son, that he can actually do something about it from a distance of 15 miles, right? With what? A word? The word doesn't even reach 15 miles, with nothing other than his own inherent will. And frankly, the biggest thing is that he has to believe that Jesus will actually do it. And he has no second options. If this man leaves and Jesus doesn't do it, the son will be dead by the time he gets back. The man left his son with his son on the verge of dying. The trip has been at least 6 hours over and well over a day going back. When he finally meets the servants, it's the next day. Okay? The son is going to die unless Jesus actually does it. And Jesus puts the man in a position where he has to leave with nothing. So that's the man's choice. He has to decide whether or not he can simply take Jesus at his word. He has to put faith in not just who Jesus is, he's the guy that everybody says he is, but he has to put his faith in the fact that Jesus will actually do what he said he will do. And Jesus didn't give him a whole lecture. Jesus didn't run through and say, "Do you know the history of God's dealings with his people? Let me just give you an idea of who it is that I represent. Let me show you just how faithful I will be before I promise to heal your son." He doesn't do any of that. The man shows up, he says, "Go, your son will live." End of interview. Leave the office. And he's curt with him. He's short. You know, thinking back in my own experiences with Russian chinovniki, you know, if I finally got into an office and one of them is cold and brief and says, "I understand, I'll take care of it, please leave," I would leave with absolutely no hope whatsoever. And that's basically the choice the man has to make. And the amazing thing, the real pinnacle of this whole passage, is the second half of verse 50. The man took Jesus at his word and departed. That is belief summed up right there. The man took Jesus at his word. He didn't know Jesus. He didn't know Jesus from the dozen other Jewish miracle workers wandering around Galilee at the time. And there were a lot of others. There were a lot of others who claimed to be Messiah. There were others who were casting out demons. There were others who were purported to do these kind of works. This man may have been to others, in fact. He doesn't know Jesus from anywhere else, but it simply says he took Jesus at his word. But that's not even the critical thing. The critical thing is, and departed. He left. He put it on the line. He obeyed Jesus. He took him at his word, in particularly in a situation where if Jesus doesn't come through, he's ruined. That's the real heart of it. He takes Jesus at his word in a situation where to act and Jesus doesn't come through is a disaster. In a place where he has no other options, in a place where walking by faith will be ruinous, he takes Jesus at his word and acts on it. Kind of stepping back and remembering that Jesus kind of stuck this man in this situation. Think about your own life. Has Jesus kind of stuck you sometimes in a dead end to force a decision on something? I know in my life he has over and over again, and I know many of you, I know your stories well enough, that I know that he does that. That we're kind of cruising along and we think all is fine, and you know there's some question there, you know, that we've never really had to look at. You know, we come in on Sunday and we sing, "I surrender all." And maybe we even go so far as to stop and think, "Well, goodness, do I really?" But we don't really know. But then God sticks us in one of those dead ends. He sticks us in a place where it makes all the difference. And if we're really surrendered, we'll do that. And if we're not, we'll do that. And we know that to obey in that situation could be a disaster if Jesus doesn't come through. Right? But he does. He puts us in those positions specifically so that we will have the blessing. Okay. The other thing that's amazing about this situation when he says the man took Jesus at his word and departed. We have in this moment when the man is standing there before Jesus, all his hopes have been shattered. I mean, you can just imagine his whole trip, 6 hours he's walked up here, the whole time he's been envisioning everything will be okay if on the way back I have this guy with me. And in two words, Jesus has trashed all of those ideas, and the man is just faced, "What do I now do?" In that moment, when he chooses to take Jesus at his word, we have a literal reenactment of one of the most central events of the entire Old Testament. Right? Genesis 15:6. When God says to Abraham, I will bless you. And he uses a way that means basically, I will bless your socks off. I am going to bless you, blessing you. It's a way to exaggerate, right? And it says that Abraham believed, and it was accredited to him as righteousness, right? We have the same thing happening in this man's life right now. Abraham, when God spoke to him, Abraham simply chose to believe him. Abraham had no reason to believe him. Abraham didn't see how it was going to work. Abraham had no proofs. God wasn't going to give him proofs. God simply said, I will do it. And Abraham chose to believe him. In the same way here, this man makes the exact same step that Abraham makes. He exercises the exact same faith that Abraham exercises. We remember Abraham. Half the world reveres him. This man is right beside him. This man here does the exact same thing that Abraham does. He chooses to simply take God at his word. And you know what? Here he receives the exact same blessing that Abraham received. The man gets what it is that he wants. Right? It takes him a couple hours to get back, but he finds his son is healed. But then he gets infinitely, infinitely more. Right? In the passage, it twice says that the man believed. When it says he took him at his word, originally in the Greek, it says he believed. Okay? And then when he gets home and he sees what has happened, then it says again that he believed. So he's believed here at a whole other level. And I know that for a lot of people have experienced that kind of thing. You've heard my personal testimony of my conversion a couple times. And that night before, in the practice room, when Jesus spoke to me and said, I can fix this, the problem that I was dealing with, when he said, I can do it, give it to me, I took him at his word. I dropped the problem, I put it in his hands, and I walked away from it. I stopped trying. And in that act, at some level, I believed. But then the next morning, when I saw Jesus come through, that's when I understood that my life was now in his. That was that moment when he suddenly became everything. That was the moment when, similar to the Samaritan woman, God opened my eyes and I saw the well of water. Right? And that's what happens to this man. He asks for Jesus to heal his son, and he believes the word that Jesus gives him. But then, when he sees Jesus come through and give him what it was that he asked for, he finds on top of that that he receives infinitely, infinitely more, something that he could have never even thought of, something he could never have conceived of, something he could never have asked for. He receives that well of water, and he's born again, and he discovers this whole new life, and he has this new relationship. And it's because by exercising the same faith that Abraham exercised, he enters into the blessing that Abraham was blessed with. He enters into the promise of Abraham. He becomes a true son of Abraham, whether he was by birth or not. So he receives infinitely more than he had asked for. And why? Because he took Jesus at his word and acted. That's the key. He did something. He took a course of action that would be disastrous if Jesus doesn't come through. And you know what? Churches are full. I hope I'm wrong. Sometimes I'm too negative. But churches, many churches, are full of people who have all the right creed. Jesus is Lord. I surrender all. They know all the words, but they've never actually been in a place where they made a decision, where they went out on a limb, where they did the stupid thing, and they risked everything, and they put themselves in a position where they will ruin their life if Jesus doesn't come through and do what he said he would do. That's frightening. I personally find that frightening. Because what are you left with? You're left with a spectator faith. You're left with the faith of the Galileans that Jesus said, I'm not interested, I'm not pleased, I'll have nothing to do with it. The faith that's pleasing to Jesus, this is what the passage is really about. The faith that's pleasing to Jesus is the faith that takes him at his word by acting, particularly in a way that will prove disastrous if Jesus does not come through and do what he said that he will do. Do you take him at his word? When he says, do not be concerned over what you will eat and drink and wear. Can you put your weight down on that? When Paul says, and we believe that the Lord is speaking through him, that all things work out for good for those who love God, can you put your weight on that? Can you risk? When it says that, lo, I am with you always, when it says that, no, I will never, no, never forsake thee, can you put your weight on that? And all the other promises, the promises that we know so well. Do you know what? It is such a problem that we know the Bible so well. It's our greatest blessing, and it's also our greatest curse. That you can read the Bible, and phenomenal, life-changing promises, we can read them, and we can say, oh yeah, isn't that beautiful? And we just keep right on reading. When you hit those famous promises, when Jesus says those earth-shattering things, stop a moment and let your earth be shattered. When you hit those famous passages where Jesus says those amazing things, stop and think. Wait a minute. What is this going to look like? When Jesus really does this in my life, what will it look like? And if I saw that now, today, if I saw my God fulfilling all my needs, if I saw God giving me all the seed that I need to sow and be generous, if I saw the breads returning that I've thrown on many waters, right? If I had already seen that, how would I live today? And then just look, are you willing to do that? Because if not, what do you have? You have the faith, I know that I use this illustration way too frequently, and it takes too long to explain with the tight wire over Niagara Falls and the guy for some reason going back and forth with a wheelbarrow, okay? You remember it, right? What you're left with is that faith, like the Galileans, is just standing around cheering, wanting to see him take somebody across the tight wire and saying, yeah, we believe you can do it, and refusing to get in the wheelbarrow. Can you take Jesus at his word? Are you willing to take Jesus at his word? And the reason that I say that it's frightening is because if we're not, it's worse than standing in the crowd cheering. The reality of it is that then it's the faith that James talks about when he says faith without works is dead. This obedience, this acting, this stepping out and taking the risk that will be disastrous if Jesus doesn't come through, that's the work of faith. When James talks about works, it's not the works that Paul is talking about. Paul talks about people who are trying to do things to earn God's approval. James, when he speaks of work, he's talking about the work of faith. The things that people do if they really believe God. And a faith that doesn't have anything that it really does because it believes God is no faith at all. It's a dead faith. And Jesus will have nothing to do with it. This is the same idea that's behind the common phrase that, I don't know if people have heard it as much as I've heard it, but belief or faith isn't what you believe. It's what you do based on what you believe. Faith is not what you believe. Faith is what you do. And that's this man here. He took Jesus at his word. Good job. We're proud. And he departed. And that's the worst thing he could have done in the situation, except for the fact that Jesus can be trusted to do what he says he will do. The faith that's pleasing to God, the belief that's the belief that the New Testament talks about, that brings the new birth, is an action. It's when we step out and we do what it is that we would do if we saw that God had already come through. Amen.